that's been established for our businesses and our society. A system of dopamine-driven performance that rewards us for individual achievement at the expense of the balancing effects of serotonin and oxytocin, that reward us for working together and building bonds of trust and loyalty. It is this imbalance that causes stock markets to crash. It is this imbalance in corporate cultures that affects the stability of large organizations. Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, and Lehman Brothers are just a few examples of large, quote-unquote, stable organizations that collapsed because of imbalances in their cultures. The seeming lack of effort to want to change the system only creates greater imbalance of the chemicals. And so the vicious cycle continues. Our health is at risk, our economy is at risk, the stability of our companies is at risk. And who knows what else? The big boomer generation has, by accident, created a world quite out of balance. An imbalance, as history has proven over and over, will correct itself suddenly and aggressively unless we are smart enough to correct it ourselves slowly and methodically. Given our inclinations for instant gratification and the weak circles of safety in our organizations, however, our leaders may not have the confidence or patience to do what needs to be done. Obviously, we can't simply blame an entire generation for the ills we face today, nor can we blame an industry or particular CEO or the corporations. There aren't any comic book-style archenemies running companies trying to take over the world, who we can simply set our sights on overthrowing to right all that is wrong. But there is a lack of empathy and humanity in the way we do business today. There are smart executives running companies and managing systems, but there seems to be a distinct lack of strong leaders to lead the people. As Bob Chapman, CEO of Barry Waymiller, is fond of saying, "No one wakes up in the morning to go to work with the hope that someone will manage us. We wake up in the morning and go to work with the hope that someone will lead us." The problem is, for us to be led, there must be leaders we want to follow. Dehumanization. Our internal wiring, though complicated and messy in practice, is pretty straightforward in intention. Designed during a time when we lived in small groups with limited resources and great dangers around us, our chemical incentive system was built to help us manage and thrive in what was a very tangible world. We knew all the people with whom we lived and worked. We saw the things we needed and we worked together to get them. We saw the things that threatened us and we worked together to protect each other from them. The problem now is we have produced an abundance of nearly everything we need or want, and we don't do well with abundance. It can short-circuit our systems and actually do damage to us and our organizations. Abundance can be destructive, not because it is bad for us per se. Abundance can be destructive because it abstracts the value of things. The more we have, the less we seem to value what we've got. And if the abstraction of stuff makes us value it less, imagine what it does to our relationships. The scale at which we're able to operate today is sometimes too big for us to wrap our heads around. By its very nature, scale creates distance. And at distance, human concepts start losing their meaning. A consumer is just that, an abstraction of a person we hope will consume whatever we have to offer. We try to guess what this consumer wants, so that they will consume more of what we have. And if they do, we will keep track of lots of metrics, so that we may better manage the process. And as our processes, metrics, and scale continue to grow, we employ technology to help us operate at greater speed and scale. In other words, the human beings, the end users of all this, become so far removed from the people who mean to serve them that they simply become just another metric to be managed. The more distance there is between, or the more things we do that amplify the abstraction, the harder it becomes to see each other as human. It's not the abundance we need to manage or restrict, it's the abstraction. We no longer see each other as people. We are now customers, shareholders, employees, avatars, online profiles, screen names, email addresses, and expenses to be tracked. The human being really has gone virtual. Now, more than ever, we are trying to work and live, be productive and happy, in a world in which we are strangers to those around us. The problem is, abstraction can be more than bad for our economy. It can be quite deadly. Part 5. The Abstract Challenge. Chapter 13. Abstraction Kills. "Let me out of here," he shouted. "Let me out! Let me out!" Kept in a small room with no windows, he started banging on the wall to get the attention of others. "You have no right to hold me here," he screamed. The man enlisted to help that day sat at the control console. He started to get nervous. He could hear the muffled pleas from the other room. He looked up at the man in charge, and, as if stating something not already terribly obvious, he said, "He's in pain." But the man in charge showed no emotion. Nothing. He said only one thing. "The experiment requires that you continue." And so the man enlisted to help that day turned back to the control panel, muttering to himself, "It's gotta go on, it's gotta go on." He flipped the switch and administered another electric shock to the stranger in the other room. "You have no right to hold me here," shouted the man in the other room again. But no one answered him, and the experiment continued. "Let me out," he continued to scream hysterically. "My heart's bothering me, let me out." Then suddenly the screaming stopped, and the experiment was over. As World War II was moving towards its conclusion, the main architects of the Nazi movement, Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, and Joseph Goebbels, managed to escape capture by committing suicide. Others were not able to avoid justice. They were rounded up and put on trial for their roles in the systematic genocide committed during the war. Crimes against humanity was one of the charges levied against the 24 most senior Nazis captured, most of whom were found guilty for their respective roles. But there was one man who was conspicuously absent during the Nuremberg trials. Nazi SS Obersturmbannführer, or Lieutenant Colonel Adolf Eichmann, played a significant role in the organizing of the Holocaust. He was responsible for managing the logistics of rounding up and deporting mass numbers of Jews and other unwanted groups to the ghettos and concentration camps across Eastern Europe. He was the one who oversaw the process that sent innocent men, women, and children, young and old, to the death camps. But after the war, using falsified papers, he was able to escape Germany and make his way to Argentina. For 15 years, Eichmann lived a relatively normal suburban life under the name Ricardo Clement, until he was captured by Israeli agents in 1960 and brought back to face trial in Jerusalem. Eichmann's capture reignited debate over how the Holocaust could have happened in the first place. It wasn't possible for just a few warped minds to have effectively committed genocide on such a remarkable scale. That amount of planning and organization and logistics required the help of thousands, if not millions, of people. It required the involvement of all levels of soldiers perpetrating the actual crimes, and millions of ordinary Germans willfully turning a blind eye. Some believe that there was a collective intent, that an entire population had abandoned all humanity and morality. Others saw it differently. The common defense that many Nazis and Germans offered after the war was less dramatic. "We had no choice," they said. "We were just following orders." That was the mantra. Whether they were senior officials held accountable for their roles, or ordinary soldiers and civilians who tried to rebuild a sense of normalcy after the upheaval of the war, they were able to rationalize their actions, avoiding personal responsibility by holding their superiors accountable. This is what they would tell their grandchildren. "We were just following orders." Stanley Milgram, a Yale psychologist, wanted to understand more. Were we humans such lemmings that if someone who outranked us, someone in a position of authority, ordered us to do something entirely counter to our moral code, our sense of right and wrong, we would simply obey? Sure, it's possible on a small scale, but on such a mass scale? So in 1961, just a few months after Adolf Eichmann's trial began in Israel, Milgram designed an experiment to understand our obedience to authority. The experiment was relatively simple. In each enactment, there were two volunteers. One would play the role of the teacher, and the other would play the role of the student. The person who played the student was actually another scientist involved in the experiment. To assign the roles, the real volunteer was asked to pick a piece of paper out of a hat that indicated if they would be the teacher or the student. In fact, both folded pieces of paper said teacher on them, giving the illusion to the volunteer that their role was picked by chance. The volunteers who played the role of the teachers, recruited from a newspaper ad and told they were taking part in an investigation into memory and learning, sat at a console with a series of switches. Each one was told that a series of questions would be asked of the student. If the student got the wrong answer or refused to answer the question, the teacher was to flip a switch on the console to administer an electric shock to the student. In fact, the only electric shocks administered during the entire experiment were mild 15-volt shocks given to the teachers just so they could have a sense of what it felt like. There were 30 switches on the console, labeled from 15 volts to 450 volts. With each switch labeled in 15-volt increments, it was made very clear to the teacher that with each switch, the shocks would get increasingly more severe. To make sure that the teacher understood the implications of the increasing severity of the shocks, there were also labels placed above certain ranges. The voltage range from 15 to 75, for example, was labeled slight shock. Written above the 75 to 120 volt range was moderate shock. The 135 to 180 volt range was labeled strong shock. Very strong shock, intense shock, and extremely intense shock covered the next few ranges until the voltages reached danger severe shock above the 375 to 420 volt switches. The final range, 435 to 450 volts, was painted red and marked simply XXX. There was no confusion as to what the switches meant. The 160 volunteers were put through the experiment with four variations, 40 volunteers for each setup. In one variation, the scientist playing the student sat right next to the teacher, and the teacher had to physically place the student's hand on a shock plate. In another variation, the student was in the room with the teacher. The teacher could see and hear the student's reactions after each shock was administered. There was no uncertainty about the impact of each successive decision to flip a switch. In another variation, the student was kept in a separate room. Though the teacher was unable to see the effects of the shocks, they could clearly hear the student's protests and screams through the walls. In all these variations, the teacher could hear the scientist playing the role of the student, pretending to express discomfort at first, and then shouting and pleading for the experiment to end as it progressed. "Stop," they would scream. "This hurts." In yet one more variation, however, the student was kept in another room, and but for the thumping on the walls, the teacher could neither see nor hear the student's reactions to the shocks. As expected, all the volunteers expressed concern. As they realized or believed that they were causing pain to the student, they would look up at the scientist standing next to them in a white lab coat holding a clipboard in hand, and ask if they should continue despite the pain they were knowingly inflicting. The first time the volunteer expressed a desire to stop the experiment or no longer be a part of it, the scientist would say, "Please continue." If the volunteer expressed a desire to stop a second time, the scientist would always say, "The experiment requires that you continue." As they went further and further down the line of switches, some of the volunteers started to get nervous, very nervous. They started sweating and shaking. Although extremely uncomfortable, most went on with the experiment. Upon the third request to halt the experiment, the scientist replied coldly, "It is absolutely essential that you continue." After a fourth protest, the scientist simply responded, "You have no other choice. You must go on." If any other protests were expressed, the experiment would end immediately. How far do you think you would go? How much pain could you cause someone before you would stop? Most of us would say we would not go very far, and that we would have quit long before we believed we had caused any serious harm to someone. And the scientists expected the same thing. Before the experiment, they predicted that 2 to 3% would go all the way, and that those people would exhibit psychopathic tendencies. But the actual results were horrifying. When the volunteers had to physically place the student's hand on the shock plate, 70% quit the experiment without going very far. When the volunteers were in the same room, but didn't have to physically touch the student, the number went down slightly, with 60% refusing to continue. But when they could neither see the students in pain nor hear their cries, only 35% refused to continue. That means 65% of volunteers were able to go through the entire experiment, reach the final switch, and for all intents and purposes, kill someone. The experiment has been criticized for being unethical, and for good reason. Nearly 80 people who woke up that morning with the belief that they were good people went home that day with the knowledge they could kill someone. Though they expressed concern, though they were nervous, though they had a sense that what they were doing could have a negative impact, even a seriously negative impact, the majority still went all the way. Upon the conclusion of the experiment, despite believing that the student may be hurt or worse, the volunteers expressed concern for their own culpability, insisting that they should not be held responsible. Not a single volunteer showed any concern for the students' well-being. None asked to look in the other room. They were more concerned with their own skins. Eventually, the volunteers were debriefed and shown that the student, who was played by a scientist, was fine and unhurt. They were assured that no shocks were given and no pain was caused at any time. Some of those who obeyed, who went all the way, now felt remorse for what they had done. They had a sense of personal responsibility. Others who went all the way, in contrast, justified their actions by blaming the scientist. If there were any repercussions, they reasoned, it would be the guys in charge, not them, who would be held responsible. After all, they were just doing as they were told. Some even went so far as to transfer blame to the student. "He was so stupid and stubborn," said one volunteer trying to come to terms with his actions. "He deserved to be shocked." Interestingly, nearly all those volunteers who refused to continue to take part in the experiment, once they realized they were causing pain to someone else, felt accountable to a greater moral imperative. Some were religious, but all of them felt that they were accountable to a higher authority than the scientists in the room. The reality is, Milgram's experiment is being carried out every single day in offices across the country and around the world. The cycle of abstraction endemic to our brand of capitalism is easily seen when we take a broader view of Milgram's conclusions. Abstraction is no longer restricted to physical space. It also includes the abstracting nature of numbers. The bigger our companies get, the more physical distance is created between us and the people who work for us or buy our products. At such scale, we can no longer just walk into the aisles and count the cans of soup on the shelf either. Now we rely on documents that report the numbers of what we've sold and how much we've made. When we divorce ourselves from humanity through numerical abstraction, we are, like Milgram's volunteers, capable of inhuman behavior. Just like the conditions Milgram set in his experiment, the physical separation between us and those on the receiving end of our decisions can have a dramatic impact on lives, the lives of people who cannot be seen or heard. The more abstract people become, the more capable we are of doing them harm. Chapter 14, Modern Abstraction. Milgram's findings come to life. In 2009, the New York Times and nearly every other major news outlet carried a story about an outbreak of salmonella that killed 9 people and sickened more than 700 others. The outbreak triggered the biggest food recall in American history. The contamination was traced to products made by over 300 companies using peanuts and peanut meal supplied by the Peanut Corporation of America, PCA, of Lynchburg, Virginia. Did the head of PCA do everything in his power to make sure the people who trusted him and his company were safe? Sadly, no. FDA investigators concluded that PCA knowingly shipped tainted products, charges the company denies. And the extensive evidence that company executives put enormous pressure on employees to meet targets is hard to ignore. Stuart Parnell, the president of the Peanut Corporation of America, sent an email to one of his plant managers complaining the positive salmonella tests were costing us huge bucks, causing obviously a huge lapse in time from the time we pick up the peanuts until the time we can invoice, according to court documents. The company went out of business in 2009. 4 years later, as this book was going to press, federal prosecutors filed criminal charges against Mr. Parnell and his team. When our relationships with customers or employees become abstract concepts, we naturally pursue the most tangible thing we can see, the metrics. Leaders who put a premium on numbers over lives are, more often than not, physically separated from the people they serve. Putting Mr. Parnell aside, what about all the people who worked in the company who did as they were told? In a weak culture, employees see their employer just as Milgram's subject saw the scientist, as the final authority figure. A leader who presides over a weak culture does not invest in programs to build the confidence of their people so that they will do the right thing. Instead, command and control perpetuates a system in which people will more likely do the thing that's right for them. Uncertainty, silos, and politics, all of which thrive in a command and control culture and work counter to the concept of a circle of safety, increase our stress and hurt our ability to form relationships to the point where self-preservation becomes our primary focus. Anything that separates us from the impact our words and actions have on other people has the potential to lead us down a dangerous path. As Milgram showed us, when we cannot see the impact of our decisions, when the lives of people become an abstraction, 65% of us have the capacity to kill someone. When we are unable to see or hear the people we're hurting, fears of getting in trouble, losing our jobs, missing the numbers, or disturbing our place in the pecking order become primary drivers of decisions. And just as the German soldiers who defended their actions by pleading that they were just following orders, or Milgram subjects who muttered to themselves, "The experiment must continue," we have our own modern mantras to defend ourselves or pass on accountability when our decisions harm others. We work to provide shareholder value or fulfill our fiduciary duty, all the while defending our actions as within the law, or claiming that the decisions were made above our pay grade. During the time I was researching this book, I had an argument with an investment banker at a dinner I attended. With my new understanding in hand, I pressed and pressed him on his responsibility to the people who were impacted by his decisions. I was stunned how he parroted Milgram's volunteers. "I don't have the authority to make those kinds of decisions," he said to me. "It's not my job. My job is to find the best value for my clients," he defended. When we do not feel safe from each other in the environments in which we work, our instincts drive us to protect ourselves at all costs instead of sharing accountability for our actions. Faced with the reality of what the banking industry did to the economy in 2008, some bankers went beyond simply blaming the mortgage companies. Just like Milgram's executioners, trying to distance themselves from the role they played and the harm they caused, even blaming the student, some bankers went so far as to blame the American homeowner for their troubles. Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, told his shareholders in 2010, "We're not evicting people who deserve to stay in their house." The responsibility of business. "There is one and only one social responsibility of business," said Milton Friedman in 1970, 6 years before winning the Nobel Prize in Economics, "to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game." By the rules, I believe Friedman was referring to the law, a well-intentioned yet imperfect set of guidelines filled with accidental or sometimes political loopholes designed by well-intentioned or sometimes political people. Friedman's words seem to have become the standard for American capitalism today. Over and over, companies demonstrate a preference for adhering to the letter of the law in their aim to drive profit over any moral responsibility they may have to people they serve or the country or economy within which they operate. Translated to Milgram's experiment, too many leaders of companies prefer to obey the scientist instead of a higher moral authority. They can justify their actions as within the law while ignoring the intention of the laws they aim to uphold. Apple managed to sidestep paying tens of billions of dollars in taxes by setting up subsidiaries in Ireland, where companies are taxed based on where they are incorporated. Apple is incorporated in the United States. The U.S. tax code, in contrast, calculates a company's tax liability based on where it keeps or makes its money. Apple was keeping all the money it made in Asia and Europe in Ireland. This distinction allowed Apple to fall between the cracks of the two countries' tax laws, and in so doing, between 2009 and 2012, it kept $74 billion out of the reach of the IRS or any taxing authority for that matter. This is a fact Apple does not deny. As one of the great innovators of our day, the technique Apple pioneered of routing profits through Irish subsidiaries and the Netherlands, then to the Caribbean to avoid American taxes, has been copied by many other companies since. Yet Apple, according to Friedman's thinking, broke no rules. We have an absolute need to form bonds of trust. Our survival depends on it. To that end, our primitive brain is constantly evaluating the words and behaviors of companies exactly the same way it evaluates the words and behaviors of individuals. On a biological level, trust is trust, regardless with whom it is formed. If someone says or does something that makes us feel that we couldn't trust them with our lives, then we keep our distance. Simply following the law means we should trust cheating boyfriends or girlfriends because they broke no laws of marriage. As social animals, morality also matters. Our, or indeed our company's, sense of right or wrong, despite the letter of the law, matters on a social level. This is the very foundation of civil society. Timothy Cook, Apple CEO, raised the question of responsibility at a congressional hearing about the matter. Unfortunately, the tax code has not kept up with the digital age, he said. Is it the governing authority's responsibility to close all the loopholes? Or do companies bear some responsibility also? Is this an act of civil disobedience by Apple to force the government to do better? Apple is a good company that does good things, like giving to education. But because most people are unaware of those things, when they hear about Apple's tax avoidance, it can affect how we trust the company. But the problem is bigger than Apple. It seems to be the standard for doing business today, to exploit the loopholes until the rules catch up, and sometimes lobby against changing the rules. And if that's the case, then no one should have any problem with the decisions made by the Oceanic Steam Navigation Company. Within the law. The largest ships in the period before the turn of the 20th century were predominantly ferries. They moved huge numbers of people from one place to another within close proximity of the shore. Logically, the regulations that outlined the responsibilities of the shipowners were based on how ships were used at the time, as ferries. By the time the Titanic set sail in 1912, however, the regulations had not yet been updated to reflect this new breed of ocean-going vessel, the equivalent of Timothy Cook's digital age. The Titanic carried as many lifeboats as required by the law, which was 16. The problem was, the Titanic was four times larger than the largest legal classification of ships of the day. The Oceanic Steam Navigation Company, the Titanic's owner, adhered to the outdated regulation. In fact, they actually added four more inflatable rafts. Unfortunately, as we all know, on April 14, 1912, just 4 days after leaving port on its maiden voyage, the Titanic struck an iceberg far from any shoreline. There were not enough lifeboats for everyone, and more than 1,500 of the 2,224 passengers and crew on board died as a result. A ship four times bigger than the largest classification carried only a quarter of the lifeboats they actually needed. Not surprisingly, only a few more than a quarter of the passengers and crew survived that day. The entire shipping industry was fully aware that the outdated regulation would soon be updated. In fact, additional space was added aboard the deck of the Titanic in expectation of a lifeboats for all requirement. But lifeboats were expensive. They require maintenance and could affect a ship's stability. So executives at the Oceanic Steam Navigation Company decided not to add the lifeboats until the regulation said they had to. Though there were not enough lifeboats for all the passengers on board the Titanic, the company was in full compliance with applicable rules. The disturbing correlation between Apple's arguments against paying taxes and the decision of the Titanic's owners not to add lifeboats doesn't stop there. Just as the shipping industry lobbied against the change in regulations in the early 20th century, arguing that having so many lifeboats sitting visibly on their decks would hurt business because people would think their vessels unsafe, Apple and others contend that paying their actual tax liability would hurt their ability to compete. Incidentally, this is the same argument that car manufacturers used in the 1950s as seatbelt requirements were being considered. They feared that the existence of a seatbelt would lead people to think that their cars were unsafe. It may be worth noting that, as reported by the Congressional Budget Office, in 2011, American taxpayers contributed $1.1 trillion to the government, whereas corporate taxes totaled just $181 billion. Though lives may not be at stake in this shell game that many companies play, on a strictly biological level, such behavior makes it very hard for the rest of us to really trust them. Being a company of high moral standing is the same as being a person of high moral character, a standard not easily determined by the law, but easily felt by anyone. Given the scale at which so many companies now operate, it seems fair that the leaders of many large companies have no choice but to manage their businesses on spreadsheets and screens, often far removed from the people their decisions will ultimately impact. But if Milgram's numbers play out, it would mean that 650 of the leaders of Fortune 1000 companies, the largest companies in America, are able to make decisions without consideration for their impact on the lives of human beings. This goes straight back to the conditions in which we, the human animal, operate best. If we are to reduce the damaging effects of abstraction on our decision-making, based on Milgram's experiment, a sense of higher authority, God, a noble cause, a compelling vision for the future, or some other moral code, and not shareholder, customer, or market demand, is essential. When our leaders give us something noble to be a part of, offer us a compelling purpose or reason why we should come to work, something that will outlive us, it seems to give us the power to do the right thing when called upon, even if we have to make sacrifices to our comfort in the short term. And when a leader embraces their responsibility to care for people instead of caring for numbers, then people will follow, solve problems, and see to it that the leader's vision comes to life the right way, a stable way, and not the expedient way. It is not about good people or bad people. Like Milgram's volunteers, many of us work out of sight of the people our decisions affect. That means we're working at a significant disadvantage if we have any desire to do the right thing, which is different from doing what's legal. One cannot help but to recall Johnny Bravo, who, above the clouds and unable to have a visual contact with the special operations forces below, felt it necessary to fly down just so he could see those he was there to protect. When we opt to stay above the clouds, relying only on information fed to us, instead of going down to see for ourselves, not only is it harder to make the right moral decisions, it makes it even harder to take responsibility when we fail to do so. The good news is, there are things we can do to help us manage the abstraction and keep our circles strong. Chapter 15, Managing the Abstraction. Numbers of people aren't people, they're numbers. "The death of one man is a tragedy," Joseph Stalin reportedly said. "The death of a million is a statistic." Stalin was a man who well understood statistics. As General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union from 1922 to 1952, he is said to have been responsible for the deaths of millions of people, most of whom were Soviet citizens. Like so many dictator types, he had a cult of personality, operated with extreme brutality, trusted very few people, and was very, very paranoid. But he was also absolutely right about how we perceive a tragedy that befalls one person over that of hundreds, thousands, or even millions. Here are two stories to show you what I mean. Both stories are completely true. Story 1. When I wrote this book, the country of Syria was being torn apart by what was basically a civil war. Inspired by the Arab Spring that swept across the region, the Syrian people rose against the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, who took control of the country in 2000 when his father, Hafez al-Assad, died after 29 years of equally brutal rule. In over 40 years of Assad rule, two generations of Syrian men and women have known nothing else. This is a modern media world, however, and as much as the Syrian government tried to suppress news of uprising in neighboring nations, word of these rebellions made it through. But in stark contrast to the peaceful uprisings in Tunisia, the Syrian rebellion was met with extreme and intense brutality by the Assad government. World opinion did nothing to affect the Assad regime as it continued to pound a disorganized and ill-equipped rebellion with the full might of the army. United Nations estimates at the time of this book were that over 100,000 Syrians were killed by the Syrian military, including nearly 1,500 in a single chemical attack, a good many of them innocent civilians. Story 2. An 18-year-old girl was lying in the middle of the street in San Clemente, California. She'd been hit by a car driven by a 17-year-old girl. Unconscious, with one of her legs broken and pointing sideways at an unnatural angle, she was in bad shape. Cammy Yoder, an army reservist who happened to be driving past, pulled over to see if she could help. Kneeling down beside the injured woman, Cammy took her vitals. The girl wasn't breathing, and her pulse was faint at best. Immediately, Cammy began CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to try to keep the young woman alive. Not much later, an ambulance arrived, and the paramedics took over. They stabilized the young woman and took her to the hospital. A few days after the incident, Cammy wondered how the girl was faring. She was able to find the news story online and learned what had happened. She had died. This young woman, her whole life ahead of her, was gone. Which story evoked a stronger feeling, the first one or the second one? A story about tens of thousands of people struck down by their own military as they stood up for something noble does not have the same emotional impact on us as the story of one person does. We mourn the death of one young woman with an empathy that we are seemingly unable to muster for thousands of young women and children, and others struck down as senselessly and even more brutally. This is one of the shortcomings of using numbers to represent people. At some point, the numbers lose their connection to the people and become just numbers, void of meaning. We are visually oriented animals. We can pursue things we can see. If it is a person in need, we can rush to their aid. If there is a clear vision of a future state brighter than our world today, we can work to build it. And if it is to advance a metric from one number to another, we can do that too. But when numbers are the only thing we can see, our ability to perceive the distant impact our decisions may have is frustrated. It's one thing for big numbers to represent money or products, but when big numbers start representing human beings, as Stalin told us, our ability to empathize starts to falter. If your sister, the major breadwinner in her family, loses her job, it will have a significant impact on the lives of your niece and nephew. And that loss would be a deep emotional burden on your sister, her family, and probably you too. But a decision made using a spreadsheet to lay off 4,000 people at some large corporation loses tangibility and becomes something that just needs to be done to meet certain goals. The numbers no longer represent people who support their families, but simply abstractions to be calculated. Be it a politician or someone working in a company, perhaps the most valuable thing we can do, if we are to truly serve our constituents, is to know them personally. It would be impossible to know all of them, but to know the name and details of the life of someone we are trying to help with our product, service, or policy makes a huge difference. The moment we are able to make tangible that which had previously been a study or a chart, the moment a statistic or a poll becomes a real living person, the moment abstract concepts are understood to have human consequences, is the moment our ability to solve problems and innovate becomes remarkable. Rule 1. Keep it real. Bring people together. As if the abstracting qualities of numbers and scale aren't enough to deal with when trying to run an organization, these days we have the added complication of the virtual world. The internet is nothing short of awe-inspiring. It gives the power to operate at scale or spread ideas to anyone, be it a small business or a social movement. It gives us the ability to find and connect with people more easily. And it is incredible at speeding the pace of commercial transactions. All of these things are good. But just as money was developed to help expedite and simplify transactions by allowing payment to be rendered without barter, we often use the internet as a means to expedite and simplify communication and the relationships we build. And just as money can't buy love, the internet can't buy deep, trusting relationships. What makes a statement like that somewhat tricky or controversial is that the relationships we form online feel real. We can, indeed, get bursts of serotonin when people like our pictures, pages, or posts, or when we watch ourselves go up in a ranking. You know how much serotonin loves a ranking. The feelings of admiration we get from virtual likes or the number of followers we have is not like the feelings of admiration we get from our children or that a coach gets from their players. It is simply a public display of like, with no sacrifice required, a new kind of status symbol, if you will. Put simply, though the love may feel real, the relationship is still virtual. Relationships certainly can start online, but they only become real when we meet face to face. Consider the impact that Facebook and other online communications tools have had on teen bullying. 1/4 of all teenagers in the U.S. say they have experienced cyberbullying. What we've learned is that the abstractions can lead people to abhorrent behavior, to act like they're not accountable. An online community gives shy people a chance to be heard, but the flip side is it also allows someone to act out in ways they probably never would in real life. People say horrible things to each other online, things they probably would never say in person. The ability to maintain distance, even complete anonymity, has made it easier to stop acting as humans should, with humanity. And despite the positive feelings we can have when meeting people online, unlike real friendships based on love and trust, the feelings we get don't last long after we've logged off, and they rarely, if ever, stand the test of time. It seems to stir controversy when I talk about the fact that no matter how great social media is, it is not as effective for building strong bonds of trust as real human contact is. Social media fans will tell me about all the close friends they've made online, But if social media is the end-all be-all, then why do over 30,000 bloggers and podcasters descend on Las Vegas every year for a huge conference called Blog World? Why don't they just meet online? Because nothing can replace face-to-face meetings for social animals like us. A live concert is better than the DVD, and going to a ball game feels different than watching on TV, even though the view is better on television. We like to actually be around people who are like us. It makes us feel like we belong. It is also the reason a video conference can never replace a business trip. Trust is not formed through a screen. It is formed across a table. It takes a handshake to bind humans, and no technology yet can replace that. There is no such thing as virtual trust. On the website for NMX, the official name of the Blog World event, there's a promotional video in which people talk about what's so great about going to the event. Sharing ideas is a frequent advantage discussed. Getting to meet so many different people, bringing everyone together, and meeting people who do what I do, who are on the same journey. These are also frequent themes. And of course, my personal favorite, said by someone who follows many of the bloggers who attend the conference, "I got to shake their hands, and that was awesome." Even bloggers have to appreciate the irony of bringing together the champions of the blogosphere to meet in person to share ideas about the supremacy of the blogosphere. Real, live, human interaction is how we feel a part of something, develop trust, and have the capacity to feel for others. It is how we innovate. It is why telecommuters never really feel like they're part of the team as strongly as the ones who go to work every day. No matter how many emails they send or receive, no matter how kept in the loop they are, they're missing all the social times, the gaps, the nuance, the humanity of being around other humans. But what do we do in hard times when we need good ideas most? We cut back on conferences and business trips because video conferencing and webinars are cheaper. Perhaps, but only in the short term. Given how relatively new social media is, the long-term impact of all this dehumanizing is still yet to be fully realized. Just as we are feeling the impact today of the policies and practices implemented in the 1980s and 1990s that prioritize profit over people, we will have to wait a generation before we feel the full effects of our modern bias to replace real interaction with virtual ones. Rule 2. Keep it manageable. Obey Dunbar's number. In 1958, Bill Gore quit his job at DuPont to pursue his belief in the possibilities of the polymer polytetrafluoroethylene, or PTFE, commonly known as Teflon. That same year, he and his wife, Vive, started W.L. Gore & Associates in their basement. It was a friendly place, and everyone knew everyone else. But the discovery of a new polymer, expanded polytetrafluoroethylene, EPTFE, by their son Bob, changed the course of Bill and Vive's company forever. EPTFE, or Gore-Tex, as it's more commonly known, had nearly infinite applications in medical, fabric, and industrial markets. It was only a matter of time before the humble, family-oriented company outgrew its basement headquarters and moved into a factory. Business was booming and demand grew. So did the factory, and the number of people in its employ. As the story goes, one day Bill Gore walked out onto the floor of his factory and realized he didn't recognize many of the people. Things had gotten so big that he simply did not know who was working for him anymore. Something told him that this couldn't be good for him, his employees, or the company. After doing some counting, Gore concluded that to maintain the sense of camaraderie and teamwork he felt was essential for the factory to run smoothly, it should have only about 150 people. That was the magic number. Instead of trying to eke out more efficiencies by increasing the size of the existing factory, Gore would simply build an entirely new factory, sometimes right next door to an old one. Each factory was capped at 150 people. It turned out Bill Gore was onto something. Business continued to boom under this model, and, as important, the relationships among the employees stayed strong and cooperative. Today, the still privately held company has sales of $3.2 billion per year and employs more than 10,000 people around the world, and it still attempts to organize its plants and offices in working groups of about 150. Though Bill Gore was trusting his gut based on his own observations, it's no coincidence that he arrived at the 150-person limit. Rubin Dunbar British anthropologist and a professor in the Department of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University, arrived at this same conclusion. Professor Dunbar figured out that people simply cannot maintain more than about 150 close relationships. Putting it another way, he likes to say, it's the number of people you would not feel embarrassed about joining uninvited for a drink if you happened to bump into them in a bar. The earliest groups of Homo sapiens lived in hunter-gatherer tribes that maxed out between 100 to 150 people. Amish and Hutterite communities are about 150 in size. The Bushmen of South Africa and Native Americans also live in groups that cap out at about 150. Even the size of a company of Marines is about 150 people. That magical number is the number of close relationships we are naturally designed to manage. Any more than that starts to cause a breakdown if rigid social systems or effective hierarchy and bureaucracy are not implemented to help manage the scale. This is the reason senior leaders must trust mid-level leaders, because no one person can effectively manage large numbers of people if there is to be a strong sense of trust and cooperation. The reasons groups function best when they do not get bigger than about 150 people make perfect sense when you look closely. The first reason is time. Time is a constant. There are only 24 hours in a day. If we only gave 2 minutes to everyone we knew, we wouldn't get to know people very well, and deep bonds of trust would likely never form. The other is brain capacity. We simply can't remember everyone, which is why Dunbar's number is about 150. Some can remember more, and some remember fewer. In addition, as Dunbar has noticed in his research, when groups get bigger than about 150, the people are less likely to work hard and less likely to help each other out. This is a pretty significant finding, as so many businesses work to manage their growth by focusing on cost efficiencies, but ignore the efficiencies of human relationships. And ultimately, it is the strength of those human relationships that will help an organization manage at scale. Many people thought that with the introduction of the internet, Dunbar's number would be rendered obsolete. The ability to communicate with large numbers of people would become more efficient, giving us the capacity to maintain more relationships. It turns out not to be the case. Our anthropology wins again. Even though you may have 800 friends on Facebook, odds are high that you don't personally know them all, and they may not all personally know you. If you were to sit down and try to contact all of them directly, as the journalist Rick Lacks wrote about in Wired.com, you would very quickly learn that Dunbar's number wins. Lacks was surprised how few of his 2,000 friends he actually knew or who actually knew him. In small organizations, where we are able to know everyone, it is much easier for us to do the work necessary to look after them. We are, for all the obvious reasons, more likely to look after people we personally know than those we don't. If a person on a factory floor knows who the accountant is, and the accountant knows who the machinists are, they are more likely to help each other. When a leader is able to personally know everyone in the group, the responsibility for their care becomes personal. The leader starts to see those for whom they are responsible as if they were their own family. Likewise, those in the group start to express ownership of their leader. In a Marine platoon of about 40 people, for example, they will often refer to the officer as our lieutenant, whereas the more distant and less seen senior officer is simply the colonel. When this sense of mutual ownership between leader and those being led starts to break down, when informality is replaced by formality, it is a sure sign that the group may be getting too big to lead effectively. This means, for larger organizations, the only way to manage the scale and keep the circle of safety strong is to rely on hierarchies. A CEO can care about their people in the abstract, but not until the abstraction is mitigated can the care be real. The only way to truly manage at scale is to empower the levels of management. They can no longer be seen as managers who handle or control people. Instead, managers must become leaders in their own right, which means they must take responsibility for the care and protection of those in their charge, confident that their leaders will take care of them. Professor Dunbar learned that in bigger companies, ones with many hundreds or thousands of employees who are not distributed into groups of fewer than 150, employees tend to have more friends outside of their job than inside. The larger the group of people we work with, the less likely we are to develop any kind of trusting relationships with them. I had the opportunity to take a tour of the old offices of a large social media company in Northern California. I can't say which one, because the company requires that every visitor sign a restrictive non-disclosure agreement before they let them in the building. The office was a large, loft-like open space with rows of people working together. The goal of the open space was to encourage open communication and a cross-pollination of ideas. The manager giving the tour made a comment that I found interesting, given Dunbar's own findings. This company grew in part because of a culture of amazing cooperation, sharing and open communication, he told me. The company believed it was because of the open plan layout. And so, as the company grew, they kept that same layout, the one that I was being shown. But for reasons they couldn't quite explain, cooperation and open communication did not improve as the company grew. In fact, as my tour guide admitted, it got worse. Dunbar wins again. Rule 3. Meet the people you help. In 2010, Adam Grant, a management professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, set out to study the effectiveness of his college's fundraising department and to understand what worked and what didn't. The job was straightforward. Employees called on alumni and tried to persuade them to donate money to a scholarship fund for exceptional students whose families couldn't afford to pay for college. The fundraisers were instructed to describe the university's dire financial position and the impressive accomplishments of the prospective recipients. The alumni would hear about the university's need to increase its investment in computer science, say, or business administration to help create the next generation of leaders. This was, after all, the future workforce of the new economy, the callers would tell them. By all accounts, the pitch was pretty inspiring. Yet, as hard as they would try, fundraisers were having only moderate success. Their numbers didn't improve even with an arsenal of research about the sting of the recession on university budgets. Furthermore, the job had all the characteristics of any mundane work: repetitive tasks, long hours sitting still, and occasionally rude customers. Needless to say, turnover in the fundraising department was extraordinarily high, leading to even worse morale. So Grant came up with an idea to improve the effectiveness of the fundraisers, and it only took 5 minutes. Professor Grant arranged for students who received the scholarships to come to the office and spend 5 minutes describing to the fundraisers how the scholarship they received changed their lives. The students told them how much they appreciated the hard work of the fundraising department. Even though the people impacted by the work of the fundraisers were only there for a short time, the results were astounding. In the following month, the fundraisers increased their average weekly revenue by more than 400%. In a separate similar study, callers showed an average increase of 142% in the amount of time they spent on the phone and 171% increase in the amount of funds they raised. As social animals, it is imperative for us to see the actual, tangible impact of our time and effort, for all our work to have meaning and for us to be motivated to do even better. The logic seems to follow Milgram's findings, except in this case it's positive. When we are able to physically see the positive impact of the decisions we make or the work we do, not only do we feel that our work has worth, but it also inspires us to work harder and do more. A control group that had not received a visit from a student showed no improvement in sales or time spent on the phone. A third group that simply listened to a manager describe how much a scholarship meant to a student also showed no increase in performance. In other words, our bosses telling us how important our work is nowhere near as powerful as us getting to see it ourselves. The loan department of a Wells Fargo bank had a similar experience. When they invited a customer to come into the bank and describe how a loan had changed their life, how it allowed them to buy a house or pay off a debt, it had a dramatic effect on the motivation of bank employees to help more people do the same. They could see for themselves the impact their work was having in someone's life. This is a significant shift in how the employees perceive their jobs, and it is foundational to having a sense of purpose in the work we do. Without necessarily being aware of it, many of the employees stopped coming to work to sell loans and started coming to work to help people. Further proof of how much the quality of our work improves when we can attach a human being to the results was seen in a study that found that simply showing radiologists a photograph of a patient led to a dramatic improvement in the accuracy of their diagnostic findings. Adam Grant conducted another study on lifeguards at a community recreation center. One group of lifeguards was given reading material of testimonies from other lifeguards about how their work helped them advance their personal goals. A second group was given materials to read of first-hand accounts of lifeguards who had actually saved the lives of swimmers. Those who read about the lifeguards saving people's lives were far more motivated at work and devoted more time to helping swimmers than those who read about how the job could help them personally. Many of us would say we're not surprised by these findings. After all, it seems rather obvious. Or does it? Grant surveyed several thousand executives to find out how important it was to them that they feel their work has value. The results? Only 1% of the executives said managers should bother showing employees that their work makes a difference. If anything, many companies try to explain the value our work will have in our own lives, the benefits we will reap if we hit a goal, as opposed to the benefit that others will derive. But remember our biology. We are naturally cooperative animals that are biologically more inspired and motivated when we know we're helping others. This is one of the reasons I love the organization Charity Water. If you give them a donation, which you can do at charitywater.org, besides the fact that 100% of that donation goes to the cause that they are championing, to bring clean drinking water to the 700 million people who don't have it, they will actually send you a photograph and GPS coordinates of the well your money paid for. Though going to Africa and meeting people yourself is even better, it is quite powerful to see the actual result of the donation you give. Most of us, unfortunately, will never see the people whose lives our work touches. For the vast majority, the closest we come to seeing results is evaluating numbers on a spreadsheet or reading about what customers like in a report. If the line on the graph goes up, we're told we've done well and we should feel proud of what we've accomplished. We are expected to feel something for the numbers and think about the people. Our want to invest more time and energy is, however, biologically tied to the opposite, to feel for the people and think about the numbers. It makes sense for social animals that our sense of purpose is always human. Rule 4. Give them time, not just money. Let's say you're moving to a new house. To help you out, one of your friends pays for the moving company. A very generous offer, worth $5,000. Another friend comes to your house and helps you pack the boxes, load the truck, travel with you to the new house, unload and unpack the boxes. 2 weeks later, both friends need a favor from you on the same day. Which would you feel more inclined to help? The one who wrote a check or the one who committed time and energy? Money is an abstraction of tangible resources or of human effort. It is a promissory note for future goods or services. Unlike the time and effort that people spend on something, it is what money represents that gives it its value. And as an abstraction, it has no real value to our primitive brains, which judge the real value of food and shelter and the behavior of others against the level of protection or safety they can offer us. Someone who gives us a lot of money, as our brains would interpret their behavior, is not necessarily as valuable to our protection as someone willing to commit their time and energy to us. Given our obsessive need to feel safe among those in our tribe, our communities, and our companies, we inherently put a premium value on those who give us their time and energy. Whereas money has a relative value, $100 to a college student is a lot, $100 to a millionaire is a little. Time and effort have an absolute value. No matter how rich or poor someone is, or where or when they were born, we all have 24 hours in a day and 365 days in a year. If someone is willing to give us something of which they have a fixed and finite amount, a completely non-redeemable commodity, we perceive greater value. If we waste money, we can make more, especially in our society. But we've all had the experience of sitting in a meeting or watching a movie, or maybe even listening to this book, and thinking to ourselves, I will never get this time back. You can save time if you stop listening now, but I cannot give you back the time you've already spent to get here. Sorry. And it's not just time. The energy we give also matters. If a parent goes to watch their kid's soccer game, but only looks up from their mobile device when there's cheering, they may be giving their time, but they haven't given their energy. The kid will look over to see their parents head down most of the game, busy texting or emailing the office or something. Regardless of the intentions of that parent, without giving their attention, the time is basically wasted for both parent and child. The same is true in our offices when we talk to someone while reading our emails or sit in a meeting with one eye on our phone. We may be hearing all that is said, but the person speaking will not feel we are listening, and an opportunity to build trust or be seen as a leader who cares is squandered. Just as a parent can't buy the love of their children with gifts, a company can't buy the loyalty of their employees with salaries and bonuses. What produces loyalty, that irrational willingness to commit to the organization even when offered more money elsewhere, is the feeling that the leaders of the company would be willing, when it matters, to sacrifice their time and energy to help us. We will judge a boss who spends time after hours to help us as more valuable than a boss who simply gives us a bonus when we hit a target. If a colleague told you that over the weekend they gave $500 to charity, what would you think of them? We'd think they were nice, but we would probably wonder why they were telling us. Did they want a medal or something? If another colleague told us that over the weekend they volunteered their time to paint a school in the inner city, what would you think of them? That's cool, we'd think to ourselves. I should do more. Simply hearing about the time and energy someone gave to others can inspire us to want to do more for others too. Remember your oxytocin. Though we may get a shot of chemical feel-good from the money we give, it doesn't last long, and it isn't likely to affect how others view us. Someone participating in a walkathon finds it personally fulfilling and does more to raise their status than the one who simply donated to their effort. Giving time and energy actually does more to impact the impression others have of us than giving money. This is the reason a CEO with a bad reputation can't redeem themselves by writing checks to charity. That's not behavior we view as valuable to the tribe. It is also the reason we are more tolerant of the missteps or occasional bad decisions made by a CEO whom we believe to be genuinely committed to the protection of their people. A leader of an organization can't simply pay their managers to look out for those in their report. A leader can, however, offer their time and energy to those in their care, and in turn those managers would be more willing to give their time and energy to their subordinates. Then their subordinates would in turn be more inclined to give their time and energy to their direct reports. And at the end of the chain, the people with the outward-facing jobs are more likely to treat the customer better. It's just biology. The oxytocin and serotonin make us feel good when time and energy are given to us, which inspires us to give more of ourselves to others. Business is a human enterprise. It may even be why we call a business a company, because it's a collection of people in the company of other people. It's the company that matters. Rule 5. Be patient. The rule of 7 days and 7 years. I went on a first date with a woman recently. It was an amazing first date. We spent nearly 8 hours together. We went for brunch, strolled around the city. We went to a museum and then for dinner. We talked and talked the whole time. We were both smiling, giggling. We even started holding hands a few hours in. As a result of that amazing first date, we've decided to get married. Needless to say, we're both very excited. You flinched a bit when you heard that last bit, didn't you? It's normal when we hear stories like that. Our immediate reaction is, that's crazy. But you weren't on my date with me. We're in love, I swear. The fact is, we instinctively know that the strong bond of human trust cannot be formed after one date, or even after 1 week. In contrast, if I told you I've been dating the same woman for 7 years and we're not married yet, you might think, what's wrong then? The strong positive feeling we may have after a great first date, or even a great job interview, is not love or trust. It's a predominantly dopamine-fueled feeling telling us that we think we found what we're looking for. Because it feels good, we can sometimes mislabel it as something more stable than it is, even if both parties feel it. This helps us explain how the love at first date may crumble soon after. It also helps us understand why someone we loved in an interview, a few months into the job, doesn't turn out to be a good fit for the organization. It's because we didn't actually spend time enough to get to know if we can indeed rely on the person. Jumping straight in, even if it feels right, is nothing short of gambling. It may work out, but the odds are against you. It is just as bad if we stay too long without ever feeling like we belong. If we've been at a job for 7 years and still don't feel it, well, maybe it's time to move on. Our internal systems are trying to help us navigate the social world so that we can find people who may be more willing to give of themselves to help us and be part of our circle of safety. It takes time to get to know someone and build the trust required to sustain a relationship, personal or professional. Our world is one of impatience, a world of instant gratification, a world ruled by dopamine. Google can give us the answer we want now. We can buy online and get what we want now. We can send and receive information instantaneously. We don't have to wait a week to see our favorite show. We can watch it now. We've gotten used to getting what we want when we want it. This is all fine and good for movies or online shopping, but it's not very helpful when we're trying to form the bonds of trust that can withstand storms. It takes time, and there's no app that can speed that up. I have no data to say exactly how long it takes to feel like we trust someone. I know it takes more than 7 days, and I know it takes fewer than 7 years. I know it is quicker for some and slower for others. No one knows exactly how long it takes, but it takes patience. Chapter 16. Imbalance. For an animal designed to live and work in conditions in which resources were relatively scarce, having too much of anything can create some inherent problems for the forces that influence our behavior. For 40,000 years, we lived in a predominantly subsistence economy. We rarely had significantly more than we needed. It was only about 10,000 years ago, when we first became farmers instead of hunters and gatherers, that we started to move into a surplus economy. Able to produce more than we needed, we could now grow our populations beyond about 150. We could trade our surplus with others. We could afford to waste more than was thought prudent in an earlier age. And we could afford to have standing armies and intellectual and ruling classes. Whenever a group moves from subsistence to surplus, ruling classes, those with the greatest surplus, work hardest to mold society to meet their expectations. The question is, are they using their surplus to affect change that is good for society or for themselves? It should come as no surprise that the richest companies work hard to lobby legislators to make or eliminate regulations to suit their interests. They may have more resources to use, protect, and further accumulate. And if not properly managed, the cultures of these organizations can fall out of balance. Destructive abundance is what I call this imbalance. It is what happens when selfish pursuits are out of balance with selfless pursuits, when the levels of dopamine-incentivized behaviors overwhelm the social protections afforded by the other chemicals, when protecting the results is prioritized above protecting those who produce the results. Destructive abundance happens when the players focus almost exclusively on the score and forget why they set out to play the game in the first place. For all the organizations that suffered from destructive abundance, there's a clear pattern that provides lessons for the rest of us. In nearly all those organizations, the cultures weren't managed properly. There was almost always a leader who didn't take their responsibility as a leader to heart. Once the destructive forces of abundance really set in, integrity started to falter, and cooperation gave way to politics, until the people themselves became just another commodity to be managed like the electricity bill. Destructive abundance almost always follows when challenge is replaced by temptation. Challenges and Temptation. Part 6. Destructive Abundance. Chapter 17. Leadership Lesson 1. So goes the culture, so goes the company. A culture sacrificed. Long-term greedy. These were the words Gustav Gus Levy, the venerable senior partner at Goldman Sachs, would use to describe the way the company operated. The year was 1970, and Goldman was a gentleman's organization, one that believed in partnership and doing what was best for the client and the firm. Given their reputation these days, it sounds funny, but Goldman bankers were known as the billionaire Boy Scouts for their seeming desire to always try to do the right thing for their clients. Long-term greedy meant that sometimes it was worth taking a short-term hit to help a client because the loyalty and trust it produced would, in time, pay back in spades. And pay back it did. Like so many organizations with a strong culture, Goldman Sachs grew while rivals struggled or failed. Starting in the 1970s and lasting until the early 1990s, it seemed Goldman could do no wrong.